This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Used to Avraham Avinu last week. At the end of Parshas Noach, we were told that Terach lived for 70 years and gave birth then to Avraham, to Nochor, and to Haran. And Avraham, Nochor, and Nochor took wives for themselves. The name of the wife of Avraham was Sarai, and the name of the wife of Nochor was Milcah. And Sarai had no children. Terach took Avraham his son, and Loit his nephew, and Sarai his daughter-in-law. And they all went from Ur Kasdim on their way to the land of Canaan. And they came to Choron, and they stopped a while there, but they were on their way to Eretz Yisrael. And Terach lived 205 years, and he died in Choron. And then this week the Torah starts with Vayomer Hashem el Avraham, Lech lecho me'atzecho, mimoladetecho, mibeisavicho, el ha'oretz asher ar'eko. Go for yourself from your land and your birthplace and from the house of your father to the land which I shall show you. And so the story goes. It's quite astonishing how much of Avraham's background is omitted. One would think that there's little as important to us as knowing a little bit about who Avraham was, about his childhood, about his development, about his spiritual development. Avraham, the one who discovered the Ribbono Shel Olam, an amazing feat of intellectual achievement, never before performed and never repeated afterwards. For an individual in a world of total idolatry, using the power of his own intellect to reach an understanding of what the Ribbono Shel Olam was and who he was, to discover him, no mention of it. Avraham Avinu, who took those concepts of monotheism and taught the world, no mention of it. Avraham Avinu, who was mocked by the world and jeered at by the world and laughed at by the world and continued unabated in his path of monotheism, no mention of it. Avraham Avinu was subjected to the most tremendous and enormous pressure by his family, by his friends, by his society, by the political leaders of his time. Avraham doesn't move. Avraham remains faithful to his beliefs in the Ribbono Shel Olam. No mention of it. Avraham Avinu finally is confronted by Nimrod, and because of his beliefs, is willing to throw himself into a furnace of fire. No mention of it. It's Torah Shebaal Peh, it's in the oral law, it's not in the written law. How is that possible? And what's greater? The Akedah, which is made such a thing of, it's a Kriyas HaTorah on Rosh Hashanah, and it's a big basis of our whole belief, where Avraham Avinu is told to bring up his only son Yitzchok as a sacrifice, and he does it willingly. Good. It's a great nisoyon, it was a great trial, and it proved a great deal. But is it that much greater than the much younger Avraham Avinu? Before the Ribbono Shel Olam spoke to him, before he had direct knowledge of the Ribbono Shel Olam, he only had his own thoughts. Throwing himself into a furnace of fire? Was that any less of a nisoyon than the Akedah ultimately? The Akedah, after the way he's communicated with the Ribbono Shel Olam, and the Ribbono Shel Olam has revealed himself to him, and the Ribbono Shel Olam himself instructed him, but in the case of Nimrod, God didn't say jump into the fire. He didn't have one mitzvah, he had no knowledge of the Ribbono Shel Olam at all, except what he worked out with his own intellect. And on the basis of that, he was willing to jump into the fire. Not mentioning that's strange. The second question, which on the surface appears to be disconnected, is the whole episode of Lot, which seems to be entirely inconsistent with Avraham's philosophy of his behavior. Lot follows Avraham, also leaves, also travels with him to Eretz Yisrael, cleaves to him, learns with him, studies with him. And eventually there's an argument between the shepherds of Lot and the shepherds of Avraham. The argument is a halachic argument, a question of whether they are entitled to allow their sheep to graze anywhere, or whether they have to move them muzzled from one place to another so that the sheep should not graze. Does the land already belong to them, or doesn't it belong to them? And Avraham and Lot themselves disagree on the matter. And eventually, Vayomer Avraham el Lot, Al nosehi merivo beini uveinecho, let there not be an argument between you and me, uvein royai uvein royecho, and between my shepherds and your shepherds, ki anoshim achim anachnu, because we are brothers. Halo yichol oretz lefonecho, the whole land is before you, yiporet no me'aloi, separate from me, im hasma'il ve'emino, if you go left, I will go right, ve'im ha'emin ve'asmi'ilo, and if you go right, I will go left. Avraham Avinu, who worked so hard to be Makariv people, to bring people to Yiddishkeit, to establish yeshivas and Bosei Medrash, and takes in all sorts of Talmidim, and has four doors to his house. His closest Talmid, one of his very closest Talmidim, must have been his nephew Lot, who'd been with him through thick and thin, who'd learnt all his Torah from him, and they have one machlokes, they have one halachic dispute on whether the land belongs to them or doesn't belong to them. And Avraham says, Lot, it's time for you to go. Off you go. And Lot lands up going to Sodom. And Avraham leaves at that point. Where's his responsibility to Lot? It's difficult enough to understand why Lot went. But it's equally difficult to understand why Avraham not only allowed him to go, but literally expelled him from his yeshiva. Told him, off you go. You go left, I go right. You go right, I go left. We can't be together anymore. Those are the two questions with which we need to deal. And we will deal with it around the Midrash, where the Midrash explains the difference between Noach and Avraham, in as much as in the case of Noach it says, Etz ha'elukim hishalich Noach, that Noach walked with the Ribbono shel Olam. And in the case of Avraham, it says, "Hishalich lefonoi veheyetomim." Walk before me and be perfect. Rabbi Nechemya said, "Moshal le'ohavoi shel melech," can be compared to a friend of the king. Shehoyo mishtakeya betit ova. He was walking in thick mud and he was having difficulty walking. Hitzitz HaMelech, the king looked up, V'roi, so he saw him struggling. Omer le'ad she'ato mishtakei, said to him, until you land up disappearing down the mud there, Betit, hey lachimi, come with me, in my chariot, I'll help you. Hadu dichtiv esoy lekim yitzalich Noach. That's what it means when it says that Noach walked with the Ribbono shel Olam. The Ribbono shel Olam lifted him out of the mud and took him with him. What can Avraham be compared to? He can be compared to the friend of a king. Who saw the king walking in dark lanes. His friend looked out. And he, through the window, he cast light on the king. The king looked up to see where the light was coming from. He saw his friend behind the window. Omele, he said, Ad she'ato me'ili derech achaloi. Instead of showing me light through the window, boi v'heir lefonai, come and bear my torch in front of me. You can be my torchbearer. What do you have to stand behind the window? Kach omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Avraham, so said HaKadosh Baruch Hu to Avraham, Ad she'ato me'ili b'as putamya. Until you, while you're busy providing light for me in Mesopotamia, bol the heil lefonai be'eretz Yisrael, come and provide light for me in Eretz Yisrael. Midrash says. What's important for our purposes in the Midrash is to note that there was a major change in Avraham's life at a particular point. That up till one point, Avraham is compared by the Midrash to the man behind the window throwing light unto the king who's walking in the dark lanes. And from a certain point onwards, the image changes to Avrom bearing the torch in front of the king wherever the king goes. And at what point does that change take place? At the opening of our Seder, where the Rebbeinu Shem says, Lech l'cho me'artzecho me'meladetecho me'beis avicho, el ha'oretz asher ar'eko. Go to the land which I will show you. Up till now you've been in Mesopotamia, not necessary anymore. Now you carry my torch in front of me in Eretz Yisrael. So at this point where the Seder starts, which to all intents and purposes is where the Torah starts telling us about Avraham, we don't know anything about him up till now. That's the point at which there's an entire change in his relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it's the nature of that change that we need to analyze. We need to understand why prior to this change, Avraham Avinu's life is not related in the Torah, as important as it seems to be to us. And also to explain his relationship with Lot later on. And in so doing, I want to use a principle which we've been developing in the ladies' shiur. Since the ladies have gotten so good, it's a good opportunity for me to test things out. If the ladies understand it, then I try it on the men. Maybe they'll understand it also. If the ladies don't understand it, then I don't bother it on I don't bother with it on the men altogether. But the ladies understood it very well, so I think there's a chance if I explain it to the men as well, that they too will understand it. The idea is basically largely an idea of the Malbim. And it revolves around certain differences between the finishing touches of the Beis HaMikdash and the finishing touches of the Mishkan. The primary difference was that when Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, the last thing he put into it, when everything else was done, the last thing he put into it was the Aron. All the other kelim were there, everything else was in the Beis HaMikdash. The last thing that went in was the Aron. As the Aron went in, the cloud of glory came down, and the Beis HaMikdash was complete. Not so in the case of the Mishkan. In the case of the Mishkan, the very first thing that went in was the Aron, exactly the opposite. And it was only after that that the other kelim were put in, that everything else was put in place, and when everything was in place, finally, the cloud of glory appeared, and the Ribbono Shel Olam Shechina was placed over the Mishkan. We explained that there is a degree of polarity in the Olam. If we look at the world not only as our world, but as the whole world, Bereishis Bara Elokim Es HaShomayim Ve'es Horetz. If we look at that which the Ribbono Shel Olam created, heaven and earth, and regard that is the Olam. The Olam is not just what we see, not just our globe. The Olam is our globe, and the solar system, and the Milky Way, and all the galaxies that are beyond that, all the way out to the Ribbono Shel Olam himself, and the world of the angels, and all the higher worlds of the Ribbono Shel Olam, all that is part of the Olam. The polarity is the Ribbono Shel Olam's world of Kedusha on the one extreme, and our practical world on the other extreme. This world here where we're in. And the dynamics of Kedusha, of sanctity, between those two poles is very important to understand. In Kabbalah we refer to two concepts, Is Aruso del Tator and Is Aruso del Eila. An initiative from the bottom and an initiative from the top. Sometimes Kedusha is achieved through an initiative from the bottom, and sometimes Kedusha is achieved through an initiative from the top, and sometimes it's achieved through a combination of both. But we need to understand the essential components, the essential characteristics of this world and of Ribbono Shel Olam's world in order to understand those dynamics. The most important physical law that governs this world is the law of gravity. That's the very basis of what makes this world what it is, what makes it unique, and what makes it difficult to operate it, certainly if one wants to reach elevated heights. The principle of gravity is that everything comes down to the ground, and that nothing can remain suspended in midair. It's the principle of gravity. And if you want to achieve height, you've got to raise the ground. You can't achieve height without raising the ground. That's the principle of gravity. And that is not only a physical, spiritual, physical concept, a law of physics, it is also a law of spirituality. It's a law of the Torah as well. You can't jump. You can jump, but when you come down, you'll hurt yourself. If you want to raise your level, there's only one way to do it, and that's to raise the level of the earth on which you stand, but your two legs have always got to be firmly on the ground. And the whole avodah, the whole service of the human being in this world, is to raise the olam, is to raise the level of the ground on which he stands, and consequently he himself will be raised. That's why we don't like to isolate ourselves from the world. That's why we don't like to separate ourselves from the world in a sense where we might be able to raise ourselves theoretically, and we leave the world where it is, and there's a big gap between the world and us, and all that means is that one day the law of gravity requires that you fall. That's not what we're meant to do. And as we've learned very often, and this is showing towards the end of the Sefer, where he talks about the extent to which our function is to elevate the world, not to elevate ourselves, to elevate the world. That's what the function of the Jew is. And just as an individual might design himself a magnificent home on the 50th floor of a tall building, where he would take the entire floor and he would make a penthouse there. It hasn't happened yet in Johannesburg, but in some of the very big cities, the prime residential property is right in town, where all you have to do to get to your office is take an elevator. And you don't have to travel the hours and hours that many commuters do have to travel. Johannesburg is still too small for that. But those people that do live in town, in the prime property areas, London and Paris and New York, all the big American cities, they like their homes to be very high up, so that they're away from the noise and they're away from the pollution. And they have the advantages of being out in the suburbs, uncrowded and clear air, and they have the proximity to the center of town. So you might design for yourself a house on the 50th floor. But to build that house, you need to build 49 floors first. It's not possible to achieve your ambition of living 50 floors high unless that 50th floor sits on the 49th floor, and the 49th floor sits on the 48th floor, and the 48th floor sits on the 47th floor, and so you go all the way down, right to the point, in fact, where you've got to dig below the surface of the ground in order to reach the foundations. You've actually got to dig down, and from there start building up again. But the building has to be standing on the ground. Ultimately, that 50th floor has to be standing on the ground. All you've done is you've elevated the ground. You've made your 49th floor is now the ground, and you build on top of the 49th floor, but you don't suspend it in midair. That's because of the law of gravity. If there wasn't a law of gravity, you could make your penthouse wherever you wanted and suspend it at whatever height you wanted. It wouldn't be necessary to make 49 floors. And so in spiritual achievement, there's no way that one can get to Beis without doing Aleph first, or to get to Gimel without doing Beis, or to get to Dalet without doing Gimel. It's a slow process, a step-by-step process, and one has to elevate oneself slowly, step-by-step. But in the world of the Ribbono Shelom, things are not so. The world of the Ribbono Shelom is not governed by gravity. And in fact, the world of the Ribbono Shelom is governed by inverse gravity. Things automatically fly up. Spiritual things automatically go upwards. And therefore, if the Ribbono Shelom, in theory, wants to plan his ideal home on the 50th floor, that's where he starts, with the 50th floor. Doesn't need anything else. And the 50th floor will automatically remain on the highest level possible. What happens if the Ribbono Shelom would like to make his home accessible to us ordinary mortals? Then although he's not governed by the law of gravity, since we are, and we can't jump up to that 50th floor, he's got to provide means for us to get there. So he's either going to provide a stepladder, or he's going to provide other floors. He's going to build down. After he's built his 50th floor, he can build a 49th floor. He doesn't have to start from the ground, because the 49th floor automatically goes up and will stick to the highest point it can, which is just below the 50th floor. And when he's finished the 49th floor, he can build the 48th floor. And so he can bring his building down until he gets to the ground floor where we can come into the building. So the dynamics of Kedusha from the Ribbono Shel Olam works from the ideal down to the diluted. Whereas in our case, it works from the diluted towards the concentrated. We start with the dilution, with a solution. We start with the very basics. We start with our 2 feet on the ground. And little by little, we work up and up and up and up until we come closer to the ideal, to the absolute. The Mishkan was representative of a miraculous kind of existence. The Mishkan did not represent normal existence. Because when the Jews lived in the Midbar, they didn't live a normal existence. They lived a godly existence. They didn't eat food, they ate mom. They didn't drink ordinary water, they had the water from the Be'er of Miriam. All they did was they sit and learnt all day. They weren't governed by the normal limitations of the world. Their clothes didn't get old and torn and worn, and their shoes didn't wear out, although they were walking miles and miles. They weren't affected by climatic conditions. They weren't affected by time. And that's why the Torah could be given to nobody but those who ate the mon, those who were released from all the normal constraints of a physical existence. So existence in the desert was not a physical existence, it was a spiritual existence. And it was that spiritual existence that the Meraglim, that the spies were reluctant to give up for Eretz Yisrael. They liked it, they preferred it, they felt it would be a tremendous yirido, it would be a tremendous drop to have to sacrifice that spiritual, idyllic, perfect existence that they had in the Midbar and replace it with a natural existence in Eretz Yisrael. And so the Mishkan didn't represent the normal system of Kedusha governed by the law of gravity, but it exists. It represented the system of Kedusha governed by the inverse law of gravity. And therefore the first thing that goes into the Mishkan is the absolute. The first thing that goes into the Mishkan is the ultimate, the Orah. Now you would start bringing it down. And so the kelim of less and less Kedusha were put in afterwards, one by one, until finally the Mishkan was ready to operate. But in the Ribbono Shel Olam's ideal world, the first thing you put in is the ultimate. The first thing you put in is the absolute. The Beis HaMikdash was a different story. The Beis HaMikdash was not collapsible. It was not portable. A portable Mishkan also represents something which is not governed by time and place. You can put it up anywhere, anytime. The Beis HaMikdash is governed by time and place. It only has one place and you cannot move it. And it has one time. You cannot move it from one generation to another. The Mishkan could be folded up and stored and opened in another generation. And so the Beis HaMikdash was subject to the normal constraints of physical existence. It was made from stone, it was made from rock, it was made from wood, it was built, it stood with its 2 feet on the ground, and it couldn't be moved and it couldn't be collapsed. That was the Beis HaMikdash. And it was in Eretz Yisrael where there was a natural existence. No longer were the Yidden living a supernatural existence as they were in the Midbar. In Eretz Yisrael, they had to plant their food, and they had to reap their food, and they had to engage in the normal business with a great deal of siyata dishmaya. Things went a lot more miraculously and a lot quicker than they would in other countries, but it wasn't the Midbar kind of existence, it was a natural existence. And so the Beis HaMikdash represents that which was normal and that which was natural. There you've got to start with the ground floor first. And the last thing you put in is the Aron. Once you've got everything else ready, the last thing that one puts in is the Aron, containing the Luchos HaBris. David HaMelech was not permitted to build the Beis HaMikdash. However, he was given a great deal of credit for having conceived of the idea of the Beis HaMikdash, of being dissatisfied with the Mishkan, with the portable Mishkan, and desiring a Beis HaMikdash. And the credit is referred to by Shlomo in his opening speech when he opens the Beis HaMikdash. And he says, Vayehi im levav Dovi, and it was in the mind of my father David, Livnois bayis l'shem Hashem Elokei Yisrael, to build a home for the Ribbono Shel Olam. Vayemer Hashem el Dovi, and Hashem said to David my father, This which was in your mind to build a house for me, you've done very well that this was in your mind. That's wonderful that it was in your mind. He gets full credit for it. But you can't build it. Time's not ready yet. In other words, it is the right time to conceive of it, but it's not the right time to do it. There's a difference in timing between when one needs to conceive of an idea and when one needs to put the idea into practice. Why is there that difference? Why is there that gap? And so we explained that in the world of thought, we operate differently again. In the world of thought, if you're planning your building, when you're planning your penthouse on the 50th floor, what do you think of first? You start with a penthouse. And you plan it in full detail. And then you plan the rest of the building in order to support the penthouse. And finally, when everything else is planned, you plan the foundations. But you can't plan the foundations of a building before you know how high the building is going to be. You can't plan the foundations of a building before you know what shape the building is going to have. Oh, the builder comes in, just as we're talking about buildings. You can't have the foundations, you can't work the foundations of a building if you don't know what shape it's going to have and what size it's going to be. And therefore, in the planning stage, in the thought stage, one starts with the ultimate. Even in this practical world, when you're thinking, you've got to start with the ultimate. Very often, an individual will plan a project. He wants to build a yeshiva. He wants to build a school. What does he start with? The ultimate. How he would like that yeshiva to be in an absolute sense. Ultimately, what does he want the yeshiva to look like? When he gets down to the practicality, he might find it can't work. He's got to adapt here, and he's got to compromise there, and he's got to change there, because it's not going to work practically. But when he starts off, there dare not be any compromise in his idea. If there's a compromise in his idea, there's going to be a compromise right through. The concept has to be pure. The concept has to be absolute. The only reason for compromise is to make it work. Sometimes you have to compromise in order to make an ideal practical. But there dare not be compromises in the ideal. That not. If one looks at the Godel b'Yisrael, if one looks at the great people of Klal Yisrael, and one thinks to oneself, fanatic, imagine, I wouldn't like to be like that. Then one's right off beam. If one thinks to oneself, my goodness, that's how it should be. A pity, I can't be like that. Then one's on the right beam. There's a practical problem. But in thought, in principle, one understands what the uncompromising ideal is and what it has to be. And there has to be a reason for every compromise. Why there's no other way to do it. Otherwise one isn't permitted to make that compromise. One of the big dangers in thinking, in planning, in idealizing, is when one allows the ideal to be diluted by the practical problems. The practice can be changed by practical problems, but the ideal dare not be diluted by practical problems. That has to remain, that must stay. And so in thought, we find that you don't start with A. In thought, you start with Z. And we mentioned how many of the great inventors and discoverers and scientists, as logical and as rational as they claim to be, acknowledge that very often their first thought was inspirational. There was an inspirational thought of the solution already. And that made them think, and then they started working back to see how possible it is and how feasible it is. He gave the description of a mathematics teacher who comes into a class and puts a mathematical problem on the board. He says, this is the problem. And here is the answer. Now show me how you get the answer. Do the exercise. Why does he give the answer? Because he wants the thinking to be straight. And if the answer is going to be wrong, the thinking is going to be crooked. So he gives you the answer. You've got to know where you're going. All I want to see is how you get there. Work backwards from the answer. Develop it. Work it. When one thinks, one has to start with the answers. You can't start with the confusion. One can't start right down at the bottom. One has to think towards an ideal. One has to think towards something clear, towards something absolute. And the wonderful thing of this concept is that we find, as we discussed, there are two worlds. There's the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and there's the world of our practical world down here. In our practical world, we have to start with step one, because we are governed by the law of gravity. The Ribbono Shel Olam starts at the top and works downwards, because he's governed by the law of inverse gravity. In thinking, we operate like the Ribbono Shel Olam operates. That's the exciting concept. That when it comes to machshava, when it comes to thoughts, to thinking, to learning, there the system we adopt is also the non-gravitational system. We also start with the end, we start with the ultimate. We start with the halacha, we start with the Mishnah. The Mishnah is absolute truth, that's Torah min ha-shamayim. We know it's clear, we know it's true. And then what does the Gemara do? Starts working backwards. What does it mean? How do you get to it? Where is it in the Torah? It starts tracing all the way back to get down to the origins. But the starting point is with the absolute. You start with the ideal, you don't start with the ponderous, you don't start with the questions. You don't start from nothing. And so we find that even down here in this world, there is one activity which follows the same systems as the systems of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and which is not governed by time, and which is not governed by limitations, and which is not governed by gravity or by anything else. It's totally limitless. There is nothing that limits the potential of the human mind. Nothing at all. Because the human mind is spiritual. The human mind is a chilek eleiko mimal, that's a part of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. And it is totally limitless. Provided we start with the answers. Provided we start with the absolute, and we don't wander around looking vaguely, not even knowing quite where we're going. As long as we know where we're trying to get, the possibility of what the human mind can achieve is endless. And so we find that in thinking, we can emulate the Ribbono Shel Olam. In thinking, we can operate the way the Ribbono Shel Olam operates. In thinking, we can release ourselves from all the limitations of the physical world, and we can transcend into the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the dynamics of Kedusha that we follow are the same dynamics as the dynamics of the Ribbono Shel Olam, from the ideal down to the practical. And as a matter of interest with this concept, I explain something very important. And that is, there are two ideas which seem to be contradictory. On the one hand, there is Yiridas HaDoiris. The Gemara tells us that if the previous generation in their time was like angels, then we are like human beings. If the previous generation was like human beings, then we are like donkeys. And notice, donkeys. Not dogs, which are fairly intelligent. Not dolphins or elephants, which are also fairly intelligent. Donkeys. That's the difference. The difference between a donkey and a human being epitomizes the difference in quality between one generation and another of Gedolei Yisrael. That being the case, it's frightening to think how far we are. If you start off with Moshe Rabbeinu and you say, if Moshe was an angel, then Yeshua's generation were human beings. And if Yeshua's generation were human beings, the next generation were donkeys. And if they were donkeys, the next generation was what? And one generation further? And so we go down. How far we are. And yet we learn Torah, we don't give up. And not only do we learn Torah, but we mispalel on Shabbos, v'tein chelkeinu b'seiro secho. Give us our portion of the Torah. There is a part of the Torah that every individual, and only that individual, can reveal, can discover. And without him it won't be discovered. There's a koach hachidush, there's a creative part of learning available and open and reserved for every Jew. Can I make a contribution to Torah? Torah that's been through all these generations. It's come from Moshe and Yeshua and the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, all the way down through the Nevi'im, the Tanoim, the Amiroim, the Rishonim, the Rambam, the Rashbo, the Ramban, the Gedolei Achronim, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and the Noida B'Yehuda, and the Ktzos HaChoshen, and the Nesivos, the Baal Shulchan Aruch, to the later Achronim. And now I come along, and there's still something left for me to do. How is that possible? And what about the next generation? Still, there'll be something for them to do as well. And not only that, But we also believe the Mashiach could come any day. It's also a bit of a chutzpahdikah belief. The Mashiach didn't come in David HaMelech's generation. The Mashiach didn't come in the generation of the of Rabbi Akiva, of Rabbi Meir, and of Rabbi Yehuda, and of Rabbi Shimon. And the Mashiach didn't come in the generation of Abaye and Rove and Ravina and Ravashi. And the Mashiach didn't come in the generation of the Rambam and the Ramban and the Rashbo. And the Mashiach didn't come in the generation of Rabbi of the Vilna Gaon. The generation, the Mashiach is going to come in our generation. What are we going to do to bring him? And so there is constantly opposite and contradictory ideas. Yiridas Hadoiris on the one hand, deteriorating generations, and yet the knowledge that even our generation has in potential some major contribution to make the Torah into Kedusha, which has never been made before. How do we reconcile these two concepts? But according to what we've said, we understand our difficulty and we understand the answer. If I see ourselves as building from the ground up, then I have a major problem. That means the ground floor was built by Moshe Rabbeinu. First floor was built by Rabbi by Yeshua and his generation. Second floor was built by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and so on. And we're now on the 500th floor, whatever, and I'm going to build the 500th floor, whereas Moshe Rabbeinu could only build the first floor. It's absurd. But if we understand that in the thought process it goes the other way around. The 500th floor was built by Moshe Rabbeinu. The 499th floor was built by Yeshua. The 498th floor was built by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. And so it has been coming down. Then I understand why the next floor only we can build. We bring the Torah down and down and down, making it more and more explicable to more simple people, making it understandable to new generations. We bring it further. We've come so far away from its source. It needs to be explained in new lights with new veins and new angles, in order to make it intelligible to our generation. And only our generation can make it intelligible to our generation. And the Mashiach will come when the Torah has been worked through all the generations until it's intelligible through every single generation, right down to the very simplest. When we've completed the Torah in that way, and we are completing the Torah, that's just what we're doing. But we're completing the bottom floors. Because we're not governed by gravity, and we started with the top floors. And the bottom floors, you need midgets to build bottom floors. The giants couldn't build the bottom floors if they tried. The Rambam might not have been able to explain his Torah to our generation. Can you imagine if the Rambam walked in and started giving a shiur? Who would understand what he was talking about? It's difficult enough to understand what a present day Rosh Yeshiva is talking about. We battle, we tear our hair out, we sweat over a Reb Shimon, over a Reb Chaim, a Briskarov one generation ago. When we get further back, how much more do we sweat? The Rambam came in and started teaching, would we understand a word of it? Not a chance. Not a word would we understand. That only we can do. We can explain a Rambam to our generation. He couldn't in theory. That's the greatness of our generation. That's the contribution we can make, is bringing the Torah down to our level. And only we can do that. That's the chelik, that's that section which is reserved specifically for our generation. But not all thinking is the same. That's Torah thinking. What about scientific thinking? In Torah thinking, we look with great reverence at everything that has come before us. Because it's the higher floors that have come before us. We're building the lower floors. In secular learning, in science and technology, one looks with a little bit of mockery and derision at those who went before one. What did they know? Did they understand computers? Did they understand scientific research in space technology? Did they understand advanced atomic theory? They didn't understand all that. So one laughs at them. Because in science and technology, you're starting at ground floor. And the next generation builds first floor. And the next generation builds second floor, and builds third floor, and builds fourth floor. And so it is in philosophy. In philosophy, you start with nothing. You don't start with the MS. You try and find the MS. You try and find the truth. Where do you start from? From nowhere. Start from zero. Try and build. And so we find what we said a few moments ago, that in thought we follow the system of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's not altogether correct. We've got to say that in thought there are two options. In thought, we can follow a thought process which is based on the gravitational system, where you've got to start with one before you get to two, and you have the option of starting at the end and working backwards. You have the option of thinking along the Ribbono Shel Olam's lines. In thought, we have the choice to function as human beings or to function as angels. That's our choice. Do we want to be involved in secular thinking, or do we want to be involved in Torah thinking? In Torah thought, you start with the answer, you start with the emes, and you work back. In secular thought, you start with a question mark, you start with zero, and you work upwards. Now perhaps we can understand the questions with which we set out. The image of the Medrash. The king is walking along the dark lanes. Nobody knows he's a king. Nobody knows who he is. He can't be seen. The friend comes along and notices from his window that this is the king walking past, and throws light on him so that other people can now see it too. Later on, the king invites him to become his permanent torchbearer. Let us examine the life of Avraham Avinu. Avraham started with nothing. He had no teachers, he had no rabbeim, and he started working things out from scratch. Is there a Ribbono Shel Olam? There must be a Ribbono Shel Olam. Slowly, over a process, he works it out that there is a Ribbono Shel Olam, and that he makes certain demands upon us, and that one has to be Moser Nefesh for that Ribbono Shel Olam. To the point where he's willing to throw himself into the furnace, although he's had no tzivui, he's had no instruction from the Ribbono Shel Olam at all. That's philosophy. As great as it is, it's secular thinking. He happened to reach the emes, he happened to reach the truth. But he started at zero, and he went from 0 to 1, and from 1 to 2, and from 2 to 3. And he got to the Ribbono Shel Olam. At a certain point, the Ribbono Shel Olam reveals himself to Avraham, and the dynamics is reversed. Here it's the Ribbono Shel Olam speaking to Avraham. Lech lecho mi'atzecho, and he gives him a tzivui. He gives him an instruction. The man who opens his window and shines the torch on the king is doing so out of his own will. He observed the king's dark position. He observed the king's obscurity. He realized that he could reveal the king, and he did so. Why did he do so? Because he was told to? No. He did so because he worked out it was the right thing to do. People couldn't honor the king. They didn't see he was there. Says the king, one second, come. Join my royal household. Be one of the team. And be the permanent torch holder. That's now an instruction. That's a tzivui. The moment we have a tzivui, the moment we have a mitzvah, an instruction from the Ribbono Shel Olam, the system of thinking changes from secular to kodesh, to holy. The system of thinking changes. Now I know what the tzivui is. This is what the Ribbono Shel Olam has told me. I don't have to work it out. It's clear. Lech lecho me'atzecho. It's obvious. I've got to try and work out why. I've got to try and work out what for. I've got to try and work out how best to do it. When there are various conflicts, I've got to work out how to resolve those conflicts. I've got to deal and analyze the halacha, but I don't have to discover the halacha. The halacha is clear. When the man is told, come and hold the torch in front of the king, that's now an instruction. Is it greater? Is he in a better position or in a worse position? When he was behind the window, he was more creative. It was more innovative. Nobody told him. He just worked it all out himself. He discovered the king. He revealed the king. He threw the light on the king. Later on, the king tells him, you hold my torch. It becomes a tzivui. But that tzivui, that instruction, makes him part of the royal household. It gives it permanence. Whereas before, he could only throw light on the king when the king walked past his window. And when the king was out of sight, he could no longer do anything. Now he's in front of the king all the time, day and night. The whole thing is different. That's the difference between a tzivui and not a tzivui. If one reaches a conclusion through one's own philosophy, even assuming the conclusion is 100% right, still it's a conclusion based on secular reasoning, and it exists for as long as my reasoning exists. Not so when the conclusion is one which is based on a tzivui, when the conclusion is one which is based on an instruction from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's permanent, that's absolute, and I become part of the royal household. I'm not doing this as a favor, I'm not doing this as something of my own creation. I'm doing this because the king has instructed me, the Ribbono Shel Olam has told me to do so. And there we have the concept of Godol HaMetzuveh Ro'eseh, Mimisha Eina Metzuveh Ro'eseh. How much greater is one who performs a mitzvah having been instructed to do so than one who does it out of his own volition? The same mitzvah is being done. One worked it out himself and one was instructed to do it. One would think that the one who worked it out himself is the greater. No, says the Gemara. Godol HaMetzuveh Ro'eseh, the one who is instructed is the greater. Now it becomes a religious system of reasoning. Now it becomes a holy system of reasoning where you start with the mitzvah, you start with the absolute and you work back. How can I make this mitzvah work? How can I understand this mitzvah and how can I apply this mitzvah? And the dynamics is the same as the dynamics of the world of the Ribbono Shel Olam. From the absolute to the practical and not from the practical to the absolute. That is why that whole section of Avraham's life is not reported in the Torah. Because it isn't Torah. It happens to be emes, it happens to be true. He reached the truth. But not all truth is Torah. There can be secular. Torah truth must have a tzivui, it must have a clear, emphatic instruction of the Ribbono Shel Olam from which to start. It must have a text, it must have a Mishnah, a Gemara, a piece of Chumash. There's something you've got to start from and work your way back towards it. Secular truth, you can reach the same conclusion. But you start with nothing and you work towards that. But that's not Kedusha. And so Avraham's life as far as Torah is concerned starts with Lech Lecho Mi'artzecha. The moment he is given the mitzvah of going to Eretz Yisrael, there his life starts. Although he was on his way to Eretz Yisrael already, although his father already started the trek towards Eretz Yisrael, it became a mitzvah only at this point. And at this point starts the story of the Torah with regard to the Oves, to Avraham, to Yitzchak and to Yaakov, now that they have mitzvahs to follow. It is for that reason that it's suggested that although Avraham through his own intellect kept the entire Torah, he didn't bris himself. People ask, why didn't he bris himself? If he kept all the other halachas of the Torah, he worked it all out himself. Surely he worked out the bris milah as well. And why didn't he give himself a bris that in his old age the Ribbono Shel Olam comes and says, you must give yourself a bris? The answer is, since he knew that he was going to be given that instruction as a mitzvah, he wanted to wait until it was mitzvah, until he had it as a mitzvah. He didn't want to do it voluntarily, because you can only do that mitzvah once. And he would rather do that mitzvah as a mitzvah, as one who had been instructed, so that the reasoning should be one of Kedusha, rather than to do it out of his own volition. What about Avraham and Lot? Rabbi Isaac Shur explains that as long as Avraham and Lot had an academic halachic argument, there was no objection from Avraham's side. Obviously, in a yeshiva, in a Beis HaMedrash, there has to be debate, there has to be discussion, there has to be difference of opinion. Even between Rebbe and Talmud, there is debate and there is discussion and there is difference of opinion. That is the dynamics and that is the vitality of a learning situation. The problem, says Rabbi Isaac Shur, is in the Rashi, where Rashi brings, Lefi shehoyu royav shalot rishoyim umarim be'emtom besodes achirim. Because the shepherds of Lot were wicked and used to allow their cattle to feed in the fields of others, whereas the cattle of Avraham were muzzled. This was no longer an academic question. Lot had paskened, and he had paskened in the presence of his Rebbe Avraham. Says Avraham, in that case you have to go. The halacha is, you may not pasken in the presence of your Rebbe, and we can't have two people paskening shailas here. I'm the Rebbe. And you, if you're going to pasken, you must establish your own yeshiva, you must establish your own community. You must go somewhere else and set yourself up. And so says Rabbi Isaac Shur, Avraham uses the term diplomatically. Let there not be an argument between us, ki anoshim achim anachnu. He says to him diplomatically, Lot, we're obviously on the same level nowadays. We're brothers. You're paskening, I'm paskening. Go and establish your own community. Go and establish your own yeshiva. You can't live here under those circumstances. Says Rabbi Isaac Shur, of course, what Lot should have done was to have said, my goodness, Avraham Avinu, my apologies. I've made a mistake, I'm sorry, I withdraw it, and I wouldn't think of leaving you for a moment. No, Lot accepts it. He says, sure, okay, and off he goes to Sodom to become the chief rabbi of Sodom. Avram realizes that you cannot have a system of kedusha, of intellectual kedusha, where there is no mesoiris and no discipline in the question of psak halacha. If you're going to have talmidim paskening their own halachas, then you have a talmid who is not willing to be mekabel, a talmid who is not willing to receive. A talmid who's not willing to receive, says Avraham Avinu, is one who has no longer a place, because he is now using his own conclusions. He's heard from his Rebbe the halacha is X. He says no. Why? How does he get to why? He started at the beginning and he's worked his way through and he's come out differently. That means his method of operation is not from the absolute downwards. The method of operation from the absolute downwards is, my Rebbe has said the halacha is X. Let me work out why, because on the surface it appears wrong. Let me work and work until I understand why he's passing in that way. No, says Lot. I have come to a different conclusion and therefore I pass him differently. Not discuss and not debate. I'll instruct my shepherds that in terms of my psak, let Avraham's shepherds do what they want, but in terms of my psak, in terms of my decision, my shepherds go unmuzzled and they can eat wherever they want. Says Avraham Avinu, in that case, there's no place for both of us together. That's going to cause confusion. And that's going to cause a secular system of learning. If you're on that level where you're satisfied with your Mesiris and you're satisfied with your own psak, it's time for you to go off and do your own thing. And Lot accepts it. Here we have the basis of Avraham as the first Jew. And Avraham Avinu, who, after having achieved all the emes through, in quotation marks, secular reasoning, reasoning not motivated by tzivri, reasoning not motivated by an imperative from the Ribbono Shel Olam, but motivated from his own logic, and he reaches the entire Torah, then we see the transformation. Avraham changing himself to the Mekabel, to one who now receives those instructions from on high, and performs them not because he's worked them out, but performs them because they've been instructed, because they're at tzivri, which is a far greater level, in fact, and to do it because one's worked it out oneself. Very often we think that the greater level is to work something out and to do it because one has conceived it and one has understood it oneself. Truth is, that isn't so. Every primitive animal does what he figures is right. You don't have to be a great person to do what you figure is right. You have to be a great person to do something even if you don't figure it's right, or even if you don't understand yet its rightness. Or more important, you have to be a great person to invest the time and effort to understand the rightness of a tzivri, even if it's not something that at first viewing you would have got to yourself. And an even greater level, after I have got to it myself, to do it not because I got to it myself, but because it's a tzivri, that's the greatest level of all. And that's the level that Avraham Avinu reaches. One thing that is important to appreciate is that Simcha Zissel says that the level that Avraham Avinu reached, where he was prepared to throw himself into the furnace without a tzivri, without a Shulchan Aruch, without a Rambam, just by his own reasoning, he was prepared to throw himself, to figure that that was the right thing to do, to throw himself into the furnace. That was the precondition to the Ribbono Shel Olam's addressing him. The Ribbono Shel Olam would not have discovered Avraham. The Ribbono Shel Olam would not have addressed himself to Avraham Avinu if Avraham had not first showed his capacity to perceive and to dedicate himself to that which he reasoned was right. And Reb Simcha Zissel says the first level, precondition to Torah, is the ability, in fact, to do what one believes is right. Even logically right, not from the Torah. And that sounds, as we said a few moments ago, easy. Any animal can do it. The answer is yes, an animal can do it because an animal doesn't have a Yetzirah. It's true that any animal can do it. Human beings find it a little bit more difficult. Once an animal understands that something is right, he does it. If an animal understands that the consequences of his disobeying his master is going to be a jolly good hiding, he obeys. If the animal understands that the consequence of obeying his master is going to be a sugar lamp, he obeys invariably. A human being, even though he understands sometimes that the consequences of his actions could be negative or will be negative, still he finds it difficult sometimes to discipline himself. And says Rav Simcha Zisl, Torah doesn't start in that case. The individual who understands, I've got to go to the shops tomorrow and buy X, Y, and Z, and comes tomorrow and he doesn't go to the shops. And he says, I must go tomorrow, otherwise it's going to be no good. Comes the next day, and again he doesn't go. He's distracted. It's an undisciplined individual, an individual who isn't able to link his activities to his mind. They're going off in two different directions. I know I have to do something, and I can't do it. That's a very tragic situation. I know it's right to do something, and I will do it, and I don't do it. Total lack of control. Total lack of self-discipline and self-control. Says Rav Simcha Zisl, before that exists, Torah doesn't even start. Only after the human being is able to subject himself at least to his own reasoning, can he then subject himself to the reasoning of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And can he then go through the stage of Avraham Avinu, of converting self-discovery to being discovered by the Ribbono Shel Olam. Converting a system of reasoning from the ground upwards to a system of reasoning from the heavens downwards. To converting a system of reasoning of finding conclusions built upon earlier premises to a system of reasoning where you start with your conclusions. And your function is to analyze those conclusions, to understand those conclusions, to make those conclusions intelligible, and to put them into practice.